This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of August 7th. More countries pulled into spiraling Iran war. The Iran war expanded further across the Middle East as Saudi Arabia joined the U.S. in striking Iran-backed militias in Iraq, Yemen's Iran-allied Houthi militant group hit Saudi tankers in the Red Sea, and a U.S.-owned natural gas storage tanker at an Egyptian port was set ablaze in a drone attack. In Riyadh's first acknowledged involvement in the conflict, Saudi and American fighter jets attacked the Iraqi-based Popular Mobilization Forces, an umbrella group of Iraqi militants, in retaliation for more than 30 drone attacks on Saudi oil facilities, which the U.S. accused Iran of directing. The U.S.-Saudi operation, which killed at least 20 fighters, came hours after Iran launched a surprise ballistic missile attack at American military sites in Jordan, shattering a days-long pause in fighting. The missiles were all intercepted, but the assault marked a shift in strategy for Iran, showing it was willing to go on the offensive and not simply respond to U.S. strikes. After the drone strike at Egypt's Mediterranean port of Damietta, President Trump vowed to retaliate against Tehran, saying it's our turn to hit them. In the southern Red Sea, the Houthis claimed at least four attacks on Saudi-linked tankers since announcing a maritime blockade of Saudi ports. Iran fired on three tankers it said were using an illegal route through the Strait of Hormuz, Saudi Arabia's other major shipping route, and reportedly rejected a proposal from Oman to divide control of the strait and solicit voluntary fees. Iran's escalating attacks illustrate a fundamental shift in the war, said Jared Malson and Suha Maye in the Wall Street Journal. The hardline Revolutionary Guard exerts more power than ever in Tehran and has grown more assertive and more comfortable with a state of war that could continue for months. It suits them better than a peace in which they'd have to confront public anger over Iran's struggling economy. Their zero-sum stance makes any agreement to end the war even more remote and heightens the risk of more frequent rounds of escalation. Trump has been told that a return to major combat operations would be a hugely risky endeavor, said Eric Schmidt and Jonathan Swan in the New York Times. At a meeting with cabinet members and top advisors, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Dan Kane warned such an offensive would dangerously deplete the military's stockpile of air defense munitions. Trump and aides are also uneasy about a widening war alienating Gulf allies vulnerable to Iranian attack and a growing energy crisis. Sources say few, if any, in Trump's inner circle believed escalation was wise. The interceptor shortage could put American troops at more risk, said Ben Finley in the Associated Press. Our stockpile of Patriot interceptors has fallen from 2,330 before the war to as low as 759, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and our stash of 452 THAAD interceptors has dropped by nearly 40%. To conserve inventories, the U.S. could take more risks, such as firing two rather than the standard three interceptors at incoming missiles. That might prove fatal for soldiers on the ground. Last month, three U.S. soldiers were killed in Jordan after an Iranian missile slipped through air defenses. Meanwhile, growing hostilities between Iran and Ukraine show the war's potential to go global, said Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times. Ukraine sank an Iranian vessel in the Caspian Sea it said was ferrying military cargo to Russia, drawing threats of retaliation from Tehran. Iran has supplied Russia with drones that have killed a great many Ukrainians. Ukraine says Russia, in turn, has given Iran intelligence to target American military assets. That Ukrainians are clashing directly with Iran is an ominous step toward a wider conflagration. Trump is in a bind, said Andrew Egger in The Bulwark. Through months of negotiation, Iran has offered a steady, ironclad position, insisting on an end to sanctions, no nuclear concessions, and control of the Strait of Hormuz. Our flailing president has toggled between two demonstrably failed positions. If we bomb the hell out of them, they'll give us what we want. If we stop bombing them, they'll give us what we want. While he vacillates in the vain search for an exit strategy, the damage mounts. Petroleum reserves, missile stockpiles, global trust in the U.S.-led world order, these are finite resources that are all being spent down at alarming rates. Fauci sidesteps Senate questioning. In a dramatic showdown at the Senate, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the public face of the pandemic response over two administrations, refused to answer senators' questions about COVID's origins and declared that Senator Rand Paul had an unhinged obsession with prosecuting him. Paul, who called the hearing, said there was a mountain of evidence that the virus originated at China's Wuhan Institute of Virology and that the federal agency Fauci led funded dangerous gain-of-function research at that lab. Fauci has consistently denied that, and most experts believe the virus emerged in the wild. The 85-year-old immunologist accused Paul of trying to trap him into perjury, saying the point of the hearing was to get me to say something that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up, in his words, behind bars. Fauci was given a preemptive pardon by President Joe Biden, but it's unclear whether that covers perjury. He repeatedly invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to answer, even as senators goaded him with questions like, "What color tie are you wearing?" Earlier, Paul released excerpts from a diary Fauci kept on a government server, saying that what he wrote privately and what he told the country are two different stories. In one entry, Paul said, Fauci admitted that only two of the 12 scientists he consulted in February 2020 were certain the virus had a wild origin, while at the time the doctor was publicly dismissing any possibility of a lab origin. Paul said he'd seek to hold Fauci in contempt of Congress, saying, "There will be repercussions to your refusal to testify." Fauci got a lot wrong during the pandemic, said the Free Press in an editorial, including calling for school closures that damaged a generation of children. Now these deeply embarrassing diary entries show him reveling in his pandemic fame and gushing over the flattery of celebrities. But the diaries do more than expose his narcissism, said Jack Butler in the Wall Street Journal. They also provide evidence of deliberate deception. In late January 2020, while publicly claiming the virus came from a Wuhan live animal market, Fauci privately wrote, "We know the market was not the source, it was the amplifier." Yet that was written very early on in the pandemic, said Ari Daniel in NPR.org, before all the information was in. At that time, Fauci was under dual pressure to trace the outbreak and to prevent mass panic. "We make the best conclusions we can with the data we have at the time," says virologist Felicia Goodrum, "but you keep working and ultimately revise the original conclusions." Republicans have made Fauci out to be some kind of demon, said Catherine J. Wu in The Atlantic. Some of them insist that he wasn't simply mistaken or inept, but that he actually played a role in starting the pandemic by funding research that made coronaviruses more deadly. There is no evidence of that wild claim, but because people believe it, he has to travel with a self-paid security detail. With public health so dangerously politicized, in future pandemics, the voice of science may not be heard at all. Haitians brace for immigration crackdown. More than 330,000 Haitian migrants were set to lose their ability to legally live and work in the U.S., clearing the way for the Trump administration to conduct mass immigration raids in their communities and ramp up deportations to gang violence-plagued Haiti. As the week went to press, a Supreme Court ruling that allows the White House to end temporary protected status for Haitians and 6,000 Syrians was poised to come into effect, with the Department of Homeland Security warning that the TPS recipients' free trial of America has ended. Fox News reported that Immigration and Customs Enforcement was preparing to target the affected migrants in places like Springfield, Ohio, home to a large Haitian community that President Trump baselessly claimed during his 2024 presidential campaign had been eating cats and dogs. One Haitian woman who works as a nurse in Florida and is a mother to a U.S.-born toddler told the New York Times that her anxiety is indescribable. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is ramping up its immigration crackdown at U.S. airports. While ICE has been working with the Transportation Security Administration since last year to detain travelers with deportation orders, recent operations have also targeted people who have overstayed visas, including migrants seeking residency through their American spouses and those with active asylum claims. "You are talking about people with legitimate pending applications," said Ghassan Shami, an immigration lawyer, "not people with criminal records." Haitians and Syrians living in the U.S. with TPS have been in panic mode since the Supreme Court's decision, said Janice Armstrong in the Philadelphia Inquirer. "We're not talking about illegal aliens. They own homes, have jobs, pay taxes. Now what are they supposed to do? Where do they go? And do they take their American-born children with them?" Kicking Haitians out will also hurt the economy, said Jacqueline Charles in the Miami Herald. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican and longtime supporter of Haiti's causes, noted that Haitians fill many essential jobs, including in the healthcare sector. About 70% of Haitian people who have TPS are employed, said Gisela Salomon and Matt Sedensky in the Associated Press, which means the labor force just lost roughly 230,000 people overnight. After work authorization for his Haitian cooks and busboys ended, one Key West, Florida restaurateur was worried about whether he has enough staff to operate. "The Trump administration is driving Haitians into an active war zone," said retired Lieutenant General Russell L. Honoré in the New York Times. Haiti, an island nation dominated by armed gangs, is on the verge of total state collapse. The White House knows that it's incredibly dangerous. If it didn't, it wouldn't maintain a level 4 do not travel advisory for the country. Forcing hundreds of thousands of people there will only worsen the humanitarian crisis and feed the chaos. Midterms. Will a summer of campaigning save Republicans? Members of Congress are leaving Washington for their summer recess, said Kaylin Razor in Politico. But the break will be anything but relaxing for GOP lawmakers. With less than 100 days left before the midterm elections and with Democratic candidates up by an average of 6.1 percentage points in the generic ballot, Republicans must now spend 5 anxious and potentially grueling weeks at home in their districts. They'll try to somehow persuade voters not to punish them in November for the high cost of living, an unpopular war in Iran, and the failures and excesses of President Trump, whose approval rating has flatlined below 40% and who is loudly and regularly attacking Senate Republicans for failing to pass his Save America Act package of voting restrictions. "Parties in power usually lose seats in the midterms," said Liz Goodwin and Ben Binday in the Washington Post, and November was going to be tough no matter what for Republicans, given Trump's sagging poll numbers. But with the Iran war heating up again, pushing gas prices back above $4, some GOP pollsters are raising the alarm about the widening enthusiasm gap between the two parties' voters. While Democrats are champing at the bit, Republicans are listless and demotivated, with about 1 in 5 reliable Republican base voters saying they may stay home on Election Day or even vote Democrat. Republicans should be doomed, said Chris Stein in The Guardian, but Democrats have their own woes. For starters, the party is broke. While the Republican National Committee has nearly $130 million in cash, most of it from wealthy donors, the Democratic National Committee is $2 million in debt. If the midterms were held today, Democrats would be favored to at least win back the House, said Julia Mueller in The Hill. The latest forecast from Decision Desk HQ suggests they'll win a 15-seat advantage in the chamber and send House Speaker Mike Johnson's caucus back into the minority. But that's down 10 seats from early July, and it doesn't help that Democrats are now attacking one another in a bitter public argument over the party's future. That debate has been a gift to Republicans, said Mona Charon in The Bulwark. Earlier this year, the GOP had nothing to run on and seemed headed for a deserved drubbing in November. But candidates aligned with the Democratic Socialists of America then scored a succession of Democratic primary wins in New York and Colorado. The DSA's platform calls for abolishing prisons, borders, and the presidency while pushing sky-high taxes to fund a workers' paradise of free everything, a set of policies seemingly designed to repel swing voters. The DSA's rise has given the GOP its midterm message, said Ed Kilgore in New York. Republicans can and will now frame the midterms as a vast ideological struggle against radical socialism, with Trump and the GOP, for all their flaws, as the safer bet. Much may hinge on the final wild card of the season, said Hans Nichols in Axios. Michigan's August 4th Senate Democratic primary between centrist Representative Haley Stevens and progressive insurgent Abdul El Sayed, a leftist Muslim with a habit of equivocating about terrorism, may not be able to win in a Midwest swing state, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. But will this new red scare really make the electorate as a whole forget 21 months of rising prices, ICE killings, weaponized government, and lascivious corruption? Socialism may be an albatross around Democrats' necks, but it's likely less of one than Trump is for Republicans. Seattle, deadly shootout. Gunfire erupted at a popular food festival near Seattle's Space Needle, leaving 3 dead and 4 wounded, including a 2-year-old boy. Police said that the shooting appeared to be gang-related. A witness said he saw a 15-year-old suspect holding a handgun and firing into the crowd gathered for the event, which attracts hundreds of thousands of people. The 15-year-old was arrested, and another suspect, 19-year-old Junior C. Nico Semo, was detained and later died of a gunshot wound. Authorities are still searching for a third possible suspect. 2 bystanders, a 44-year-old man and a 56-year-old woman, were killed in the crossfire, and 4 others were hit by bullets and taken to the hospital. It was a stampede, one attendee said of the panic as shots rang out. An entire community is trying to understand how a gathering built around culture, connection, and joy ended in gunfire, said Seattle Mayor Katie Wilson. Parma, Ohio, GOP seat in jeopardy. Mounting domestic violence allegations threaten to derail an Ohio Republican's reelection campaign, leading party leaders to fear they could lose a previously safe House seat in November's midterms. Representative Max Miller, a former aide to President Trump, is accused of abusing his 2-year-old daughter and his ex-wife Emily Moreno, the daughter of Senator Bernie Moreno, Republican of Ohio. Emily Moreno said Miller held a gun to her head, threw hot water on her, hit her head, pushing her against a wall, and was responsible for his daughter's fractured collarbone and injured shoulder. "Daddy kill you," the young child once told Moreno, according to court documents. Miller vociferously denies the allegations and has accused Moreno of being mentally ill and a stalker. GOP leaders worry the controversy could cost them a seat in a critical midterm election where they risk losing control of the House. But Miller refused to consider dropping out of the race. "Texas is turning blue like I'm losing my seat," he declared. Lansing, Michigan, outbreak spreads. A former top FDA official called for an independent review of the government's handling of the diarrhea-causing cyclosporiasis outbreak as cases topped 11,500 across 41 states, with the vast majority of them in Michigan. The FDA has linked the outbreak to lettuce from Taylor Farms. The produce giant, which in 2025 donated $1 million to a President Trump-linked PAC, contacted the White House in mid-July to raise concerns that its ties to the outbreak were being overstated. Days later, the FDA retracted one test result it said was a false positive, but said it still supported Taylor Farms' voluntary recall of iceberg lettuce from Mexico. Health officials in North Carolina said their investigation suggests parsley and cilantro may be behind recent increases in cases. Trump's former top food safety official, Frank Yannis, said the FDA has bungled its response to the outbreak, which began in May. "It is starting to approach a catastrophic level," he said. Washington, D.C., Graham honored. National and world leaders attended the funeral of Senator Lindsey Graham and held a series of high-stakes meetings behind the scenes. During a service at Washington National Cathedral, President Trump eulogized the South Carolina Republican, who died at age 71 in July, calling him one of the great figures in Senate history. "Virtually everyone liked Graham," Trump joked. "Well, not everybody, but it sounds good." Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were in attendance, and they separately met with Trump to advance goals that the hawkish Graham supported. Zelensky requested more U.S. military aid to help push back Russia's invasion of Ukraine, while Netanyahu aimed to defuse tensions with Trump and keep him engaged in the Iran war. In Graham's honor, the Senate voted 86-12 to advance a bill that would impose sweeping new sanctions on Russia and Iran. Washington, D.C., retribution. The Trump administration admitted to canceling billions of dollars in grants out of vengeance against blue states, the New York Times reported. When the White House eliminated over $7.5 billion in clean energy grants in October, officials claimed they were simply trying to keep taxpayer money from going to waste. But that wasn't true. In a little noticed July court filing, an Energy Department official acknowledged cutting 284 grants based solely on politics. All but one grant recipient was located in a state that voted for Kamala Harris in 2024 and has two senators who caucus with Democrats. The administration left untouched 340 energy grants in red states, even though the Energy Department had recommended canceling them as well. The filing was part of a class action lawsuit aiming to reverse the administration's move. President Trump knows how important these Biden-era grants were to the American people, said Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, which is why he did not cut them off to the red states. Berlin, pride attack. A man known to authorities as an Islamist radical plowed a van into a crowd at a Berlin pride event, killing one woman and wounding 29 other people. The driver, Abdul Balut, 21, a German with Lebanese roots, was fatally shot by police after he rushed officers while brandishing a knife. Balut had traveled to Lebanon in 2025 with the intent of joining ISIS in Syria. He was arrested and extradited back to Germany, where a court convicted him of preparing a violent act, but suspended the sentence. He was released in May with orders to attend a de-radicalization program. Chancellor Friedrich Merz called for stricter monitoring of such cases, saying Balut should not have been allowed near Pride. Bordeaux, France, intense wildfires. More than 330,000 people in France and Spain were forced to evacuate, fleeing ferocious wildfires expected to intensify in the summer's fourth record heat wave. In June, France logged more than 5,700 excess deaths attributed to the heat. The blazes have burned more than 300,000 acres, destroying hundreds of homes and buildings. The Gironde fire alone, France's worst since World War II, has blackened an area four times the size of Paris. This is an unprecedented fire that we have never seen before in France, said Sophie Brocas, the top federal official in the Department of Gironde. It's a fire that can create its own wind that can jump several kilometers. Kumamoto, Japan, damaging quake. A magnitude 6.8 earthquake shook Japan's southern main island of Kyushu, triggering a frantic search to dig people out of collapsed buildings, including a shopping mall and a paper factory. This is a race against time, said Prime Minister Sane Takaichi. At least 18 people were killed in the quake, and some 300,000 people were evacuated to emergency shelters. Many others slept in their cars, afraid to go indoors as dozens of aftershocks continued to rattle the region for days. The quake crumpled roads, knocked out power, and damaged several historic structures, including a stone wall at Kumamoto Castle and the gates of a 16th century Buddhist temple. In the mall, the shocks caused a gas explosion that sounded like a bomb going off. People. Why Nolan is happy to be a Luddite. Christopher Nolan doesn't own a smartphone, said Robbie Collin in The Telegraph of the UK, and he has no desire to get one anytime soon. You guys have all become pod people, the director of The Odyssey, 56, says with a laugh. Why is he so anti-phone? Partly because I know I'd become horribly addicted. I'd spend all my time looking things up. But his aversion is also about his work. I find I'm only able to advance my thinking on projects in those pockets of time where everybody usually jumps on their phone, waiting for a train, in an airport, for somebody to turn up for dinner. As much as he detests phones, his greatest tech foe these days is artificial intelligence. Nolan shuns AI in his films. He used a mix of puppetry, animatronics, and computer graphics to bring the Odyssey's Cyclops to life, and is delighted that some younger cinema-goers and a growing number of Gen Z directors are utterly rejecting it. I've never seen a more rapid wholesale dismissal of a supposedly foundational jump in technology. He cites his own four children, all in their late teens and early 20s, and all digital natives. Their judgment of AI slop has been immediate and harsh. They see it for what it is very quickly, and it's much easier for them to identify it because it grew out of an online world they know really well. Cutting the food safety net. Republicans tightened access to SNAP benefits. Millions more Americans are now going hungry. How big a problem is hunger in the U.S.? The nonpartisan Urban Institute reports that nearly one in four adults last year experienced household food insecurity, defined as not having enough to eat or knowing where the next meal may come from. That's up from one in five in 2020. The Trump administration stopped collecting data on food insecurity in 2025, saying the information was used to fearmonger. For nearly 40 million low-income Americans, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as food stamps, serves as a lifeline. The 62-year-old program gives recipients an average of $187 a month to spend on groceries. Qualifying households must have an annual income below 130% of the poverty line, which this year is $15,960 for a single person and $38,680 for a family of five. Nearly 80% of households receiving SNAP benefits have members who are over 60, disabled, or under 18. But more than 4 million people, including at least 776,000 children, have been dropped from the program's rolls over the past year, largely because of changes to SNAP included in the One Big Beautiful Bill, OBBB, passed by the Republican-led Congress last summer. With grocery prices up by nearly a third since 2020, a growing number of Americans are now struggling to put food on the table. "I go to sleep thinking about what we are going to eat," said Dee McDonald, a 65-year-old cancer survivor raising three grandsons in Mesa, Arizona, and who last year lost her SNAP benefits. "I'm exhausted." What did the OBBB do? To reduce SNAP's costs by $187 billion over the next decade, the package tightened eligibility requirements and shifted more financial responsibility to state governments. States became responsible for 75% of SNAP's administrative costs, up from 50%. The OBBB also mandated states cover up to 15% of SNAP benefits if their error rate, mistakes that lead to under or overpayment of benefits, exceeds 6%. Error rates nationally sit above 10%, and only 9 states are below that threshold. Those above will face billions of dollars in new costs unless they can bring their error rates down. The OBBB also removed work exemptions from groups including adults ages 54 to 64, veterans, and parents of teenagers, all of whom must now prove they spend at least 20 hours a week working or volunteering to get benefits. Refugees were made almost completely ineligible. What's the justification for those cuts? The Republicans who passed the OBBB say the program had become bloated and strayed from its goal of helping society's most vulnerable. They also saw SNAP cuts as a means to finance the law's tax reductions. SNAP has expanded substantially in recent years. The number of recipients has more than doubled since the early 2000s, and the Biden administration lifted average benefits by more than 25% during the pandemic. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins said the recent drop in SNAP enrollees is a result of a better economy, which means people don't need food stamps, and measures in the OBBB that removed fraudulent claimants. Is there much fraud in the program? While error rates seem high, that's mostly due to unintentional mistakes, often made by caseworkers, in calculating how much an applicant should receive based on their income and expenses. And most recipients are not avoiding work to claim benefits. 89% of SNAP households with children and a working-age non-disabled adult have at least one working member. But the OBBB is making it harder for them to get on SNAP. States are scrambling to find ways to lower error rates. More paperwork to prove eligibility, phone interviews, and AI-run wage checks. That extra workload is swamping state SNAP agencies, many of which were already understaffed. In Massachusetts, over 80% of calls to the agency that administers SNAP are now being dropped. Disconnections happen automatically when there aren't enough agents to answer. Arizona has dropped nearly half of all state SNAP recipients, including Tiffany Hudson, a single mother of two who had been receiving $600 a month in food assistance to supplement her earnings as a part-time caretaker. After her benefits were cut off, she was told to provide more documentation, including a written statement that a monetary birthday gift from her father was not a recurring payment. We've been going to food banks every week, Hudson said. We're eating less. Can charities make up the difference? They're trying amid a surge in demand. A New York Fed report in February revealed that nearly 16% of Americans now rely at least partly on donated food. Sometimes people are sitting in a 2 to 3 mile line the night before a distribution starts, said Amy Brightman, director of a food bank in Augusta, Georgia. Beth Fiorenza's food bank in Phoenix has been receiving more than 200 people a day, up from 150 to 175, about 40% of them newcomers. Charities do not have the capacity to make up for the shortfall, said Harvard Health Policy Professor Sarah Blyke. For every meal that food banks provide, SNAP provides 9. Are there more changes ahead? An appropriations bill recently passed by the House would cut $141 million for fruit and vegetable benefits from the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. The program, in which nearly 5.4 million children and pregnant and postpartum women are enrolled, has historically enjoyed bipartisan support, and the bill's Republican backers argue the cuts won't limit access. But Trump's own 2027 budget proposal, submitted in April, would reduce WIC's monthly fruit and vegetable allowance for children under 5 from $26 to $10. They just don't care what they're cutting, said Mariah Hamilton, 35, a Philadelphia area mother who receives WIC for her infant son and is struggling with the rising cost of food. How much more do you think I can bear? Best columns of the U.S. A legal way to steal the midterms. Could Donald Trump and Republicans exploit a legal loophole to steal the midterm elections? Asked David French in the New York Times. Unfortunately, the answer is yes. Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution says that each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. This means that the House and Senate decide who is seated in their respective chambers, and ominously, those decisions are not reviewable by any other branch of government, including the courts. Under election law, losing House candidates can contest defeats, and the Republican majority can decide by a simple vote to seat them even if their challenge lacks evidence of fraud or error. Trump has created multiple pretexts to declare Democratic victories in November invalid. When he inevitably does, House Speaker Mike Johnson and other Republican leaders won't defy him the way Vice President Mike Pence did in 2020. If you think such a scenario is too far-fetched to be real, it's happened several times in American history, including in 1931, when House Democrats reversed a Republican's narrow victory. If control of the House comes down to a few seats, we should be under no illusions about MAGA's intentions. Showing why we need a free press. President Trump bombed at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, said Brian Stelter of CNN.com, but his belligerent flailing only served to underscore the need for America's robust First Amendment protections. Breaking his years-long boycott of the press group's annual fundraiser, Trump gave a rambling hour-long speech in which he personally insulted journalists and claimed to be single-handedly keeping the news business afloat. He told a strange number of fat jokes and a lame sex joke that produced awkward silences. When he realized his comedy routine was falling flat, he insulted his writers, saying, "Does anyone understand this stuff?" As he droned on with his recycled insults and resentments, attendees tuned out, looking at their phones, and chatted among themselves. Trump was just boring. The evening took an intriguing turn when Trump had to sit through several awards for journalists he loathes, including CNN's gutsy Caitlin Collins and Wall Street Journal reporters who documented his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. embarrassed, the president merely threw up his hands in an aw shucks-like gesture. The president's inability to cow or silence journalists unwittingly underscored the theme of the dinner, the vital necessity of a free press. Iran war. Are U.S. casualties being covered up? The Trump administration has found a novel way to limit the U.S. death toll in the Iran war, said Jack Crosby in Rolling Stone, claim that some deaths don't count. The names of four service members killed by Iranian strikes in mid-July suddenly vanished from the Pentagon's official list of war dead, lowering the total from 18 to 14. U.S. officials gave differing explanations for the change, from benign temporary data disruptions to the claim that the troops killed in Jordan and Iraq didn't actually die in the war with Iran, since Operation Epic Fury technically stopped when President Trump struck a temporary ceasefire with Tehran in April. Never mind that neither side ever ceased firing. After Senate Democrats and veterans groups protested the disappearance, the names of the four service members reappeared on the Pentagon website, but under a different category for overseas operations, which includes only those killed and injured since July 7th when fighting fully reignited. This is only the latest attempt by the administration to obscure the human cost of its unpopular war, said Edith Olmstead in The New Republic. In March, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth dismissed an Iranian drone strike on a tactical operations center in Kuwait as a squirter, and the Pentagon said just five troops were seriously wounded. In fact, dozens of soldiers suffered injuries including burns, shrapnel wounds, and brain trauma. And when the Pentagon restored the four dead soldiers to its online database, it also quietly upped the number of wounded personnel by more than 140, pushing total U.S. casualties in the war above 600. Trump tried to put a positive spin on the casualty count, said Joe Lancaster in Reason, favorably comparing in an online post the conflict's 4 months, 18 dead, with the thousands of Americans killed in multi-year wars in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That may be true, but American soldiers are still dead as a direct result of the conflict he helped instigate. This is predictable behavior from Trump, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. He has frequently treated the military as a political prop, and according to his first-term Chief of Staff John Kelly, called U.S. troops who died in wars suckers and losers. Trump and Hegseth seemed to think that the American public are suckers as well, and thought their accounting tricks would prevent Iran war deaths from becoming a political liability. But that plan backfired and has succeeded only in drawing attention to the 18 dead Americans. The administration sought to hide the war with Iran. Instead, it showed the painful and growing costs. The White House, Trump's extreme makeover. America's own Louis XIV has embarked on his next home improvement project, said Tiago Ventura in Time. President Trump recently announced the construction of a $5 million granite helipad engraved with the U.S. presidential seal on the White House's South Lawn. It's the latest flourish from a president who seeks to refashion both the White House and Washington through a series of high-profile renovation projects. The most well-known are the botched repainting of the reflecting pool and the demolition of the White House's east wing to make way for a still-unbuilt ballroom. But in total, Trump has launched 18 known projects to remake the U.S. Capitol in his own image and taste. The Oval Office has been adorned with so much gold leaf that it resembles the glittering excess of Versailles, while White House walls now bear gaudy gold script proclaiming the Oval Office, the West Wing, and the Presidential Walk of Fame. Trump claims his renovations are being funded by private donors and won't cost taxpayers a dime, said Andrew Feinberg in The Independent. But a close examination of public records reveals a pattern of ballooning budgets, non-competitive bidding, and the weaponization of federal funds to bankroll Trump's vanity projects. These improvements have drained at least $1 billion in taxpayer dollars. Trump's projects are also illegal, said Edith Olmstead in The New Republic. By law, Congress is required to approve any construction on federal land, but because congressional Republicans fear crossing the president, he has been allowed to treat the White House like one of his gaudy resort properties rather than the once dignified 226-year-old People's House. While Congress turns a blind eye, a majority of Americans don't approve, said Sarah Davis in The Hill. A recent Washington Post poll found that 2 out of 3 Americans take a dim view of Trump's extravagant renovations. When asked about Trump's motivations, 64% said he was transforming Washington, D.C. to glorify himself or leave his mark, not to benefit the public. Renovation is easier than the economy or foreign policy, said Jackie Delametre in The Guardian. While with mounting troubles both domestically and internationally, it's no surprise that Trump has retreated to the safety of these relatively small matters. He's even been caught supergluing gold accents to the Oval Office's mantle himself. In his desperation to self-soothe, Trump can't stop himself from adding just one more gilded vase. Health and science. A scary milestone for measles. The U.S. measles outbreak just set a horrifying new record. The CDC puts the count so far this year at more than 2,300 as of mid-July, edging past the record total for all of 2025, and making this the worst year since the disease was declared eliminated from the country in 2000. In fact, more measles cases have been reported in just the last 2 years than in all the years from 2000 through 2024 added together. Big clusters in South Carolina and Utah drove much of the surge, and health officials in some states now fear their outbreaks may never be fully snuffed out. Measles is ferociously infectious, with a single case capable of seeding 18 more, and its dangers don't end when the rash fades. The virus can smolder in the brain for years before triggering subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, a rare complication that is almost always fatal. More than 90% of infections have been in people who were unvaccinated or whose status was unknown. Yet only about a fifth of cases have involved children under 5. Roughly half were ages 5 to 19, and 30% were adults. That tells us this has been years of under-vaccination in some communities, William Moss, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, tells the Washington Post. This has been years in the making. It's not just the result of one outbreak. The drug that beats statins. Cheap and reliable statins are taken by tens of millions of Americans, but they can push bad LDL cholesterol down only so far. Now the FDA has approved a daily pill that goes considerably further. Enlicitide, sold under the brand Lipfendra, blocks a protein called PCSK9 to get LDL under 60 milligrams per deciliter, and sometimes under 50. Adults not on medication normally have levels above 100, but new guidelines say those at high risk of a heart attack should aim for a level under 55. There are injectable drugs that work on the same protein, but barely 1% of the 6 million Americans who qualify for the shots actually get them. That's likely because the injection regimen costs up to $600 a month and generally isn't covered by insurance. For such patients, Lipfendra could be a cheaper, easier alternative. In a 24-week trial of nearly 3,000 people, Lipfendra lowered LDL by as much as 60%, and a month's supply runs $315. This is an incredible breakthrough in heart disease prevention and care, cardiologist Mohammed Alo tells Forbes. Stocks. Chip sell-off rattles Wall Street. More than $1.3 trillion was wiped off the market capitalizations of the largest memory chip stocks as investors fretted about AI spending, said Kai Nicole Schwartz and Li Ying Shan in CNBC.com. Nvidia lost $238 billion after its share price tumbled nearly 4%. Other chip makers, including SK Hynix, Samsung, Micron, AMD, and TSMC, each lost over $100 billion. Chip manufacturers have been one of the main beneficiaries of the AI boom, but there are concerns that AI infrastructure spending has peaked. Investors also reacted unfavorably to reports that Nvidia was investing up to $250 billion in an Ohio-based data center project for OpenAI that would use its chips, reviving concerns about circular financing in AI deals. Nvidia can afford to help its customers, said Karen Kwok in Reuters' Breaking Views. But when its customers are unprofitable model developers, including OpenAI and Anthropic, it adds complexity and concerns. Investors also are right to worry about the incestuous nature of the relationships between AI companies and their chip suppliers. Last year, for instance, Nvidia's shares jumped 4% when it unveiled a similar OpenAI investment tie-up. This time, the stock dropped 4%. Nvidia has made a fortune selling picks and shovels to the AI gold rush, but it's getting riskier to rely on AI companies that are digging themselves a deeper hole. Surprise billing, the hidden cost of consumer protection. A law aimed at curtailing surprise medical billing has been surprisingly lucrative for doctors, said Anna Wild Matthews and Tom McGinty in the Wall Street Journal. Healthcare providers were awarded nearly $15 billion last year from arbitrators called in to settle medical billing disputes, more than triple the amount in 2024. It's an unintended result of the No Surprises Act, passed by Congress in 2020 in response to a surge of complaints from patients about huge unexpected bills from doctors who weren't in their insurers' networks. Patients are no longer responsible for those bills, but their insurers now battle doctors in arbitration hearings over how much they will pay. Doctors are winning around 80% of the cases. Some insurance groups allege that the system is getting gamed, said Sarah Cliff in the New York Times. Seeing the favorable results, a growing number of medical providers and billing firms have begun using it to obtain higher payments for scheduled procedures, and then winning payments that are 10 or hundreds of times as high as what insurance typically pays. The No Surprises Act has spared millions of Americans from unexpected medical costs, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. It addressed a real problem many Americans regularly experienced. Unfortunately, that great bipartisan achievement is getting abused, which means patients will start paying the bill in other ways. Several insurers, like UnitedHealthcare of New York, have already said that costs associated with the dispute process accounted for a portion of its premium hike for the next year, which could be as high as 9%. What began as an exercise in consumer protection is instead becoming another force pushing healthcare out of Americans' reach. It's a perfect example of a policy with consequences, nearly the opposite of what was intended, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The Biden administration estimated there would be 17,000 disputes every year. Last year, there were 2.6 million. Part of the problem is that arbitrators don't often throw out ineligible claims. The government should audit and discredit the obvious money grabs. However, the Trump administration finalized a Biden-proposed rule aimed at making arbitration more efficient and less expensive. This will only encourage more claims. Early drafts of the No Surprise Act foresaw this very issue, said the Washington Examiner. Those drafts required insurers to pay out-of-network providers a clear market-based benchmark rate, which was usually tied to the median in-network price for the same service in the same area. This was the simplest and fairest solution, but hospitals and medical groups argued this would be too favorable for insurers. And so, instead, the arbitration process has become a racket. Congress must fix its mistake. Charity of the Week, the Farmer's House. TheFarmersHouse.org has helped children and young adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities since 2006. Founded by two Missouri moms, Suzanne Zimmerman and Peach Cunningham, who wanted to fill a gap for other local mothers of children with special needs, the nonprofit started as a working farm offering vocational training and a fun learning environment. It is now a community program with 7 locations across Missouri offering various opportunities to learn job and social skills. Staff and volunteers opened the nonprofit's first market in 2012 to help support its initiatives, selling kitchenware, home goods, and other specialty items like pickled foods and homemade pies. Today, there are 3 markets that serve as training hubs where students with developmental differences can come to gain practical work experience through short-term paid internships. Gen Z's retirement maxers. A lot of young people have gotten obsessed with saving, said Josiana Joshua in Bloomberg. The same generation that embraces so-called looks maxing, an online neologism that refers to maximizing one's physical appearance, is now retirement maxing as well. Workers are opening retirement accounts earlier than prior generations and contributing the maximum allowed each year. Locked out of other ways of accumulating wealth, such as homeownership, maxing out a 401k offers the promise of security and freedom later, even if it means waiting years to receive the benefits. Some super savers say they also just want enough of a cushion that they won't someday get trapped in a job they don't like. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.